Welcome to the Regional Roundup, a production of Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a coalition of public and community radio stations in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, including this one. I'm Maeve Conran, the coalition's managing editor, and today, Brad Swartzwelter takes his last ride as the conductor of the Winter Park Express.
I apologize about this train being late, but as I've always said, whenever we've had a late train, it wasn't my fault.
Canyonlands and Arches National Parks get a new superintendent.
Arches is also so unique in the amazing resources it has, the amazing cultural landscape, the amazing natural landscape.
And historian Heather Cox Richardson warns about the need to safeguard our democracy.
By 2028, the demographic in this country will have shifted so that the people who are voting are ones who almost certainly will vote to protect our democracy. But we need to make sure there is an election in 2028.
From Rocky Mountain Community Radio, it's the Regional Roundup. On March 31st, at Colorado's oldest major ski resort, there was a celebration about the resurrection of a train and the conductor who's credited with its revival. Train enthusiasts, skiers, travellers and more gathered for a retirement celebration of conductor Brad Swartzwelter. March 31st marked the train's final trip of the 2024 ski season and the swan song for conductor Brad, who has logged 212 trips as conductor of the Winter Park Express since 2015. For Rocky Mountain PBS, Kyle Cook, Alexis Kikoan and Peter Vo bring us the story of conductor Brad's last ride.
I'm passionate about rail for the same reason that thousands and thousands of train fans are. I'm ill. Many, many people fight that. I simply decided to give up and embrace it. My very first train ride was when I was 2 years old, and my mother took my two older sisters and I to Ottumwa, Iowa for my grandfather's memorial service.
12.
I'm pretty sure that we were in the Silver Sky train car on that trip. From there, it never ended, and I don't even remember that trip. I've had the model train sets. I lived in Boulder where I could see the railroad going by. I was able to ride the Rio Grande Zephyr numerous times with my grandfather and my father, and it never left. I always knew that I would work on trains, and specifically passenger trains.
Ladies and gentlemen, Brad the conductor, we are now starting through a tunnel full of fresh, clean Rocky Mountain air from the western slope.
The conductor on a passenger train is the captain of the ship. The locomotive engineer controls the locomotives and makes it go, but the conductor is the one that tells that engineer when to go and when to stop. So it's a very symbiotic relationship. And then in the body of the train, the conductor is in charge of all operations.
I apologize about this train being late, but as I've always said, whenever we've had a late train, it wasn't my fault. Thank you.
In a real world sense, the conductor not only makes sure that the train gets to where it's going and lets passengers off safely and welcomes passengers aboard safely, but also is the de facto law enforcement on the train. The conductor ultimately is responsible to ensure that the train staff behave as they should. The conductor is in charge of making sure that the mechanical portions of the train either work or are closed off so that we don't get into trouble.
Hey, guys, do any of you ever hold your breath when you're inside a tunnel? All right, get ready. Let's try this once. Hold on. Ready? Wait for it. Timing is everything. 3, 2, 1.
I plan to retire in October if all goes well, and that will be the end of my professional railroading career. It's a funny thing on a train. The conductor wears the hat and is visible and talks on the PA. I get the recognition, I get noticed, but in reality, the hard work's being done on the trenches, in the front line. And there are hundreds of them. There's people that clean the train, the people that fuel the train. There is so much. And I get to be the face of it. I'm nothing. This train is nothing without everybody pulling their weight. What I'm going to miss is the people. The train itself is beautiful. The route is stunning. The resort, the destination, is as good as it could be. Getting to do the railroading where I switch the engines around and get into all the technical part is fun. But in the end, it's the connection with all of the human beings that has made it extraordinary.
You can see the video of conductor Brad Swartzwelter's last ride on the Winter Park Express at rmpbs.org. Thanks to Kyle Cook, Alexis Kikoan, and Peter Vo for that story. The National Park Service has selected a new superintendent of Arches and Canyonlands National Parks. These parks in southeastern Utah attract hundreds of thousands of visitors each year, and they're home to striking geologic formations and significant indigenous cultural sites. The new superintendent, Lena Pace, brings years of experience, having previously worked on a floating ranger station in Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve, as well as at Lake Mead National Recreation Area. KZMU's Marlene Marcello has more.
I grew up in a very small town right outside of Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve up in Southeast Alaska. And both my parents worked for the Park Service. My dad was a boat operator and my mom was an interpretive ranger, which are the rangers that man the visitor centers and do the nature walks and things like that across the parks. And so I had a lot of experience and exposure to the National Park Service early in my life. And so when I was 19 years old, I was in college for environmental studies down in Washington State. And I came home one summer and was looking for a good summer job and ended up applying for the National Park Service and was hired as a student hire, doing some interpretation and also doing some work with our resources management division. I was actually transcribing oral histories of the Tlingit people up there for a summer. So I spent a lot of time talking to visitors and going out in Glacier Bay on cruise ships, talking to visitors on cruise ships, a little bit of a different environment, and really enjoyed it. But wasn't sure that was what I wanted to do permanently in my career. And so over the next couple of summers, I would come home and work for the Park Service in the summer. I spent a season as a visitor use assistant doing permitting and talking to visitors who were going out into our backcountry, either boating or camping. And I also spent some time doing ride-alongs with the law enforcement rangers and learning a little bit more about what they did. And that last summer, before I graduated school, I was a backcountry ranger. I wasn't a law enforcement officer yet, but I was a backcountry ranger. Out in Glacier Bay, living in a floating ranger cabin with a couple of boats and a kayak and experiencing everything the park had to offer, but also talking to a lot of visitors who are out there in the backcountry using the park as well.
I could ask you a million questions about your time in Glacier Bay on a floating ranger station. That seems like what an amazing experience. Do you mind just, you know, giving me a little bit of insight into what that was like?
So in Glacier Bay, our mammals are a little bit bigger than the ones that we have in the four parks in the Southeast Utah group. And among them are bears, black bears and brown bears. And one thing that a floating ranger station offers is, number one, the ability to bring it down bay and work on it in the winter without having to leave a cabin up there, right? So we would float it down into the developed area and do some maintenance on it in the winter. But number two, it makes sure that the bears can't come and eat my food during the day. So I could cook and keep my food in a cooler and all of those things without having to worry about bears or other wildlife getting into it, which was really just a safety factor. When I was there, it's about a 12 by 12 floating cabin on anchored out in a little cove about 30 miles up into the bay with a little deck all the way around it, about 4 feet wide. And every afternoon when I cooked my meal, there was a brown bear that would walk along the shore and sniff to smell what I was cooking that afternoon. And I would wave at him and he would walk by. So I was happy to have the floating ranger cabin and I would dock my boat right up to it. I had a patrol boat up there and I would dock my boat right up to my cabin. And then during the day, I'd get in the boat and go travel around in the bay and talk to visitors out there and sometimes respond to emergencies and that sort of thing. And then I'd end up back at the floating ranger cabin. So it was really a neat opportunity to live and experience wilderness in a way that I hadn't before. I'd only done short trips before. And this was really, you know, for sometimes 10 days at a time, I would be up there in the bay and really enjoyed that opportunity to be enveloped in wildness and wilderness.
So you have had like an incredibly diverse career as far as like parks are concerned. You know, how different or similar is Arches to like the other parks you've worked at?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, there are similarities in every park. And, you know, the first thing I would say is I haven't been to a park yet that you didn't go to and recognize that there's a reason that it was protected the way it is, right? Every park is unique and has a really special and unique energy about it. You can kind of imagine yourself being the first person who saw Arches and said, this would be great to protect as public land. Arches it's similar, particularly because I came from a small town in Southeast Alaska. It was a gateway community to a large national park. Almost everyone in town, either directly or indirectly, makes a living either because of the park directly, because they work there, or because the park is there because it's protected and they're able to guide or have businesses or own lodges or help the tourists and the people who are coming to visit. Moab reminds me a little bit of my hometown in that respect, the level of pride and ownership and love that the local people have for the park and the level of support that the parks in the area provide back to the local community and vice versa, kind of that symbiotic relationship where we're all working together towards the same goals and because we love these amazing places. I think another similarity, especially today, is the diversity of uses, right? There's people who mountain bike and road bike and hike and climb and canyoneer. There's all these different ways that people like to experience the park. And I love that Arches provides that opportunity for all of these different types of activities in the park for all different types of visitors.
That was Lena Pace, the new superintendent of Arches and Canyonlands National Parks in southeastern Utah. You can listen to the entire interview at kzmu.org. And thanks to Molly Marcello for that report. You're listening to the Regional Roundup from Rocky Mountain Community Radio. I'm Maeve Conlon. Heather Cox Richardson is an historian, author, and educator. Her latest book is Democracy Awakening: Notes on the State of America. She has a daily e-newsletter called Letters from an American, which is also available as a podcast that's broadcast on some Rocky Mountain community radio stations, including KHAN in Salida. I spoke with Heather about her work and her thoughts on the current state of our democracy.
Well, let's do some terms first. I'm a historian, so I write about what the United States looks like in the broad sweep of history. And my real passion is for the democracy that was embodied by the Declaration of Independence in 1776. So when I'm talking about democracy, I'm talking about two basic things. And that is that we all have a right to be treated equally before the law, and we all have a right to have a say in our government. Those two things are outlined in the Declaration of Independence. Now, throughout our history, there have been times in which people have pushed back against those things and said, well, no, in fact, everybody doesn't have a right to be treated equally, or no, you don't have a right to have a say in your government. But I feel like if we lose those things, we have lost American democracy and replaced it with something very different, usually, you know, one person telling the rest of us what to do. So where we are right now is in a moment in which a faction of one of our two major political parties has abandoned that commitment to equality before the law and the right to have a say in your government. And this has happened before, but it is really rare. And right now we're in a unique moment because of the extraordinary power those people have within the existing United States government. And it's something that I think most Americans really don't want. Whether or not there's an R by your name or an I by your name or a D by your name, that's not American democracy. And we need to work to get that back.
I think things are playing out in different ways as well, depending on which level of government you're looking at. I mean, what you described there is certainly what's happening at a federal level. But then we have state governments and local governments. And I think if you ask people about how do you feel about government, they might have a slightly different attitude depending on which of those governments you're actually talking about. Can you talk a little bit about how some of those dynamics are maybe playing out at those different levels, federal, state, and local?
Well, so one of the interesting things you hear all the time is about how Americans are so divided. And yet, if you actually look at what Americans think about even hot button issues like abortion or common sense gun safety legislation or our public schools, any number of things, the vast majority of us are within a pretty small spectrum. We actually agree with each other. And that, I think, is much easier to see on the local level, especially in small communities. I'm from a small rural community. And, you know, Our political affiliations matter a whole heck of a lot less than who helps you shovel out your driveway in the winter. And so I think at the local level, it's really important to really grab hold of the idea that most of us are agreed and are reasonable people who want to learn to live with each other or who want to live with each other. We've already learned how to do it in our past. And that the real issue here is that at the local level, while that might work, often at the state level, you've got forces often outside the state that are working to take control of the state because of the way our system works. If, in fact, you can monopolize a state legislature through outside money often, you can have control over that state and over control of business regulations within that state. And that, in turn, you can work at the national level to change national laws, where, in fact, the parties are very deeply split. But they're deeply split, I think, because of politicians who are leveraging the idea that we are all split in order to maintain themselves in power. What I would like to see is that ordinary Americans like you and me recognize that this is our government and that we don't have to put up with this crap, that we, in fact, can take our government back and recreate a much fairer and freer system than we currently have.
And I want to talk about what people can do, because there's a huge amount of people just being quite cynical really now about how our elections are working, or really just how our democracy is working because of some of the dynamics you laid out. And you mentioned there that we are actually less divided than maybe mainstream media or certain political entities might make us think. But we are seeing that creep of national ideology or politics seeping into a very hyper local level as well. We've seen it here in the Rocky Mountain West at school board elections, libraries, the book banning, where you can hear people testifying in meetings and it's language and vocabulary and very often entire passages that is straight out of a national group's playbook. Are you seeing those dynamics playing out nationwide?
Well, we are. And actually, not to speak at the national level, but here at the local level, you know, I'm from a small community in Maine, and we see the same thing. These are not really our neighbors that are coming in with this information. It's people that are taking their orders from outside. And that is poisonous, I think. But one of the things that is really important in this moment, not only over issues like that, but more generally, is the recognition, which I think we've really had stripped away over the last several decades, that our voices matter. That, you know, you can go to a school board meeting and just sit there. You don't necessarily have to be somebody to step up to the podium and say, well, no, you're wrong, but to support those people who are doing that. Because at the end of the day, our school teachers, our police officers, especially our election officials, are our neighbors. So this idea somehow that the lady who's been sitting behind the desk at my, you know, the high school where I vote has been somehow, you know, nefariously manipulating the vote for the last 30 years is just bonkers. I mean, they are us. These attacks on our institutions that are peopled by people like, you know, ordinary people like you and me, that they are somehow part of an effort to overthrow democracy is just bonkers. And it takes a real stretch of the imagination to get there. But if that's all you're hearing, it's easier either to believe it or to keep your head down from the people who believe it. And that's a real problem. We have to speak up for this.
So what can people do then, and what certainly can communities do when we are seeing some of those dynamics that are happening at a national level seeping in and being quite destructive then at a community level? What can people do to counteract that?
Well, so in the moment in which we are living in the United States of America, many people are making the comparisons to 1930s Germany and need to recognize that even at the height of a right-wing reactionary movement like we're seeing around the country, even at the height of it, the highest number that that movement will hit is about 32%. Usually it hovers between 28% and 32% of the people who will adhere, you know, deliberately adhere to that kind of a movement. But the elections and the direction of the country are made on the number of people who just keep their heads down. They just need to get their paycheck, you know, they need to put food on the table. They need to, you know, they don't want to cause trouble. And one of the things that people said in 1930s Germany is what can I do? I'm just one person. And the trick is to find a friend. The first thing you do is make sure you're not just one person, even just two people who can go to talk, for example, or to sit at a school board meeting, means you've got somebody there with you. But if you get three people, you're starting to move toward being what they call a squad. You know, you're there with your friends. So even if the conversation is horrible and you're feeling really kind of bad about it, you've got friends there with you. So the first thing that I would say, you know, everybody says, oh, give to candidates and write letters and all that. All those things are true. But the first thing that I would say is to make a friend and then to start to do what I call taking up oxygen. That is, again, we tend to overestimate the number of people who are trying to spoil our communities and trying to destroy our country because they have so many mouthpieces, not only the real mouthpieces, but also the fact that they are able to leverage social media through bots and trolls, for example, and through spreading their message through different propaganda outlets to make it seem like they're a lot bigger than they are. Remember, top number is about, political scientists will tell you, is about 32% of the population. That's the top number. So part of reclaiming our country is recognizing that the way that those people take power is by shutting up the decent people who are kind of afraid to speak up. And then, you know, think of bullies, for example, in fifth grade. You know, they got everybody to be quiet because nobody wanted to be the next person to get pummeled by the bully. But once everybody got together and stood up to the bully, he ended up cowering in the corner. And that's sort of what we're seeing at a political level across the entire American landscape. But crucial to reclaiming this idea of American democracy and the right to have a say in your government and the right to be treated equally before the law is to recognize that that does not mean you get your way and it does not mean that everybody's going to agree. The whole point is that it's, you know, you need to argue about the tax base in your town. You need to argue about, you know, whether or not there's going to be a new highway somewhere, but you need to have the structures in place to do that in a safe fashion. And again, this is not partisan. This is about whether or not we will protect the institutions of our democracy so we are able to work together without somebody imposing on us some kind of their own dictatorship, either of religion or of ethnicity or of race or of gender or of politics or of any of the different rules that they could put in place by saying, you know, the institutions of democracy don't work, so let's throw them out. We're going to tell you how to behave. And the answer is, regardless of where you sit on the political spectrum, you're probably not somebody who would like to be dictated to. And that's one of the things that democracy does, is it protects the freedom of individuals to work within a series of laws. We're a law-based nation within a series of laws so that they don't, you know, interfere with other people's freedom, but that we enjoy our freedom to determine our own destinies. And that's really what we're looking at right now.
This is a very crucial election year. A lot of people are using all kinds of terms to describe it. A lot of the messaging being our very democracy is at stake. Now, we started our conversation talking about what our democracy is actually doing right now. But given your historical perspective, and you really do have that overview, I mean, how consequential is this year's presidential election and how are you feeling about the future of our democracy?
This is the biggie. By 2028, the demographic in this country will have shifted so that the people who are voting are ones who almost certainly will vote to protect our democracy. But we need to make sure there is an election in 2028. And the MAGA Republicans, and I'm going to call them out here with the recognition that I am a historian of the Republican Party, and I will tell you, these are not real Republicans. This is not your mother's Republican Party. The ideology of the Republican Party is crucially important to the United States of America, as is the Democratic ideology. And there is room for more ideologies in the future, but those two are definitely baked into our DNA, and we need them both. And we could spend hours talking about that. The MAGA Republicans do not believe in either the Democratic ideology or the Democratic ideology, both of which support democracy. They are actively trying to get rid of the idea of a president who is checked and balanced by the legislative branch and the judicial branch. They have put forward a set of policies to concentrate power in one person who cannot be checked. They have called for getting rid of our nonpartisan civil service, which we've had since 1883, which is designed to provide a basically the stability of a ship in which people who work for the federal government are not partisan one way or another. And they have worked and articulated a plan to get rid of our judicial interpretation of the Constitution and a plan to impose on the majority of Americans a set of religious values that belong to a certain small group of American Christians. And, you know, it's, I think if you actually did that, you would see the same sort of problem that you're seeing now with the overturning of Roe versus Wade. It's one thing to say, oh, yes, we should have these religious rules. Once you start to decide which religious rules are going to be in place, even within Protestant Christianity, you're going to have a major explosion. Just look at what happened to Europe in all its religious wars, in which there were factions among Protestants, Protestant Christians, who were killed each other. So there is this small faction who is trying to take over our democracy, and they have managed to put themselves into crucially important positions that suggest they will be able to stir up enough confusion over this election that they can perhaps throw it into the House of Representatives. It's one of the ways that you could manage to put in place former President Trump or a Trump-like figure. You know, he's not yet gotten the nomination, to impose this authoritarianism on the United States. That being said, I am 1,000% convinced that in a free and fair election, Americans do not want that. They may not agree about finances, and they may not agree about internal improvements, and they may not agree about immigration, and they may not agree about foreign affairs, but they can agree that we should protect the institutions of democracy that enable us to elect people who can have real debates about those things. The problem that we are looking at in 2024 is that because of the crucially important places that that faction has put its adherents, and because of their control of a certain number of media outlets, they are exercising an outsized control or an outsized influence on the majority of Americans. So this election is the one where, even if you think you are not interested in politics, this is the one you need to turn out for. And you need to put your finger on the scale of democracy. Small d democracy, not necessarily, you know, capital D democracy. This is our generation's opportunity to demonstrate that that vision that the founders put into the Declaration of Independence, an extraordinarily revolutionary declaration, that everybody has a right to be treated equally before the law, and that everybody has a right to a say in their government, does not die on our watch. So it's a frightening time, but it is also a time of, as I say, extraordinary opportunity to demonstrate that that vision of human self-determination that the founders first articulated in 1776 is still important to those of us living in the United States of America, and that we are willing to carry that beacon forward for the rest of the world going into the 21st and 22nd centuries.
That was historian Heather Cox Richardson, author of Democracy Awakening, Notes on the State of America. You can subscribe to her daily e-newsletter and podcast, Letters from an American, at heathercoxrichardson.substack.com. And you can catch the podcast on some Rocky Mountain community radio stations, including KHEN in Salida. You've been listening to The Regional Roundup, a production of Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a network of public and community radio stations in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, including this one. Thanks to Rocky Mountain PBS's Carl Cook, Alexis Kekoan, and Peter Vo, and KZMU's Molly Marcello and Heather Cox Richardson for today's show. Our theme music is Take Me Somewhere by Joel Adam Russell. I'm Maeve Conran. Thanks for listening.